So welcome back to Restless. My name is Father Joseph Gill, priest of the Diocese of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and you've joined myself, Paul, and Diane as we are willing to lay down our lives for Christ. That's the hope as young adults, as Catholics in today's world. And today's topic is laying down your life for Christ, aka martyrdom. And I'll tell you where this topic came from in my mind. A couple weeks ago at our youth group, I forget how we got on the topic. We were just talking about maybe church history or something. And we had the seventh grade girl that said, "I pray all the time to be a martyr." And I was like, wow, that's cool. You know, you're 12 and you pray to be a martyr. But then I thought, is that cool? Is that the right, you know, should we pray to be martyrs? I mean, is martyrdom a good thing to desire? I mean, certainly we hold up martyrs in our church as those who have given everything. And, you know, Christ says no greater love has a man than to lay down his life for his friends. So martyrdom, like, what is it? So let's just first talk about very concrete martyrs that you know. Tell me about some of your favorite martyrs in church history, because we've had a lot, over 50 million in 20 centuries who've shed their blood for Christ. Who are your favorites?
I mean, the first that comes to mind for me is Thomas More.
Mm.
I love his.
We both had the same reaction.
Love his quote. His at the end of his life, "I die the king's good servant and God's first."
I thought you were going to talk about the quote when he was about to be beheaded, and he said, "Please move my beard out of the way. It did nothing wrong." Great sense of humor on the way to the execution. But yeah, "I die the king's good servant, but God's first." Tommy More.
Yeah, cool. Saint guy. Stephen, proto martyr.
Saint Stephen, sure.
11 of the 12.
Yes,
plus Paul.
The only one, plus Paul, who was beheaded, being a Roman citizen. Yeah,
Maximilian Kolbe?
Of course, patron of the 20th century.
Kind of more recent.
Yeah, very much more recent.
Mm-hmm.
I was, shameless plug right here. I'm really fascinated by the story of St. Pancras. You ever heard of St. Pancras?
You've said it before, but I've forgotten again.
Yeah,
I think you've either had a homily or you...
Well, I wrote a book about him.
Right,
and that's where that's where my shameless plug comes in.
Kind of sounds like a body part.
You should buy my, not pancreas, right? Pancreas. You should buy my book called The Shores of Heaven, available on Amazon.com. But he was a really cool early church
martyr. My mom has that book.
Does she really?
She does.
Did she read it?
She did.
Did you read it?
No.
You need to.
Okay.
Scott Hahn's thing is that, like, you have books when you need them.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true.
Not always that you read them by definition, but you have them when you need them.
Yeah.
Now, having a stacked bookcase is like a treasure trove. It's awesome.
It is, but how many books percentage of those books have you read?
Well, that's the point.
A
you
lot.
Don't need to read them.
A
They're
lot.
There when you need them.
Just
exactly. And if you share with, like, your parents and your friends, it's like
there you go.
Basically a library.
It multiplies mm-hmm. the graces. But one of the coolest experiences I had with St. Pancras was, I studied in Rome for a year, and there's lots of catacombs all over Rome. And I used to, of course, tour the most famous one, the catacombs of St. Calixtus, where St. Cecilia was buried and St. Sixtus was martyred. But there was one church called San Pancrazio, St. Pancras. And in a city of over 900 churches, this one didn't catch my eye. You know, it was nothing that special. I mean, it was kind of cool, kind of like old, you know, 11th century, 12th century, whatever. But it was always locked. I was like, rats, you know? So finally, it was St. Pancras' feast day, which is May 12th. And I was like, let's go see if it's open. I saw it was open, and I saw that it had catacombs underneath. And I'm like, sweet. So I went down there, and for the first time, I was in the catacombs all by myself.
Whoa.
There were lights on, but nobody else was down there. And I was like, this is cool. You know, being in the very burial place of the martyrs, not just Pancras, but other martyrs were buried there too. And I was like, this is really, you know, you feel that connection across 2,000 years of history.
Hmm.
So he's one of my favorites. But
awesome.
That's great.
Yeah.
What did he do?
Yeah.
Was it like a novel that you wrote?
It was a novelized version of his life. But so he ended up dying at the age of 14. And he was born of pagan parents in modern day Turkey. And his parents died when he was very young. So he went with his uncle to Rome, where both of them converted. And he got connected with a couple other martyrs, Saints Nereus and Achilles, who were both praetorian guards assigned to basically execute the Christian niece of Domitilla. No. Domitilla was the name of the girl of the Roman emperor. Blanking on his name right now. It's pretty bad.
What century?
298 or so. End of the 3rd century. The guy who had the big persecution. What was his name?
Nero?
No. Starts with a D. I totally blanked. Anyway.
Diocletian.
That's it. Diocletian. Yeah. So they ended up taking her away, and they were so impressed by her faith that they all converted to Christianity, and they all shed their blood basically trying to protect her, you know, failing. But Pancras was very much impressed the emperor, and the emperor offered him lots of gold and silver and treasures and life in the palace if he would only just convert to the pagan religion, but he refused and shed his blood for Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Roman canon has all the martyrs, right?
Many of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Linus, Cletus, Clement, Sixtus, Cornelius,
yep.
Cyprian, Lawrence, Chrysogonus, yeah. So many of these saints desired martyrdom. You may know the story of St. Francis, who tried to travel to Egypt specifically to get martyred, like trying to meet the Sultan so he would just get his head cut off. You know, is it good to desire that? Or is it like suicide?
I mean, I can't say it's on my top 10 list of ways I'd like to go out, you know, like.
I always thought of it as that you pray that God will give you the grace to be a martyr if called upon.
Mm.
Yeah.
But going to seek out martyrdom. Well, it's like what Paul said, right? He's like, do I choose? I really want to go to heaven to be with Jesus, but there's so much good work to be done on the earth, you know? And it was like it was a challenge. It's a conundrum.
Sure.
And so too with martyrdom. It's like, yes, if I'm martyred, then I get to be with Jesus. But at the same time, do I seek it? There's so much work to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I kind of agree with you in the sense too that like if you, you pray for the grace to just lovingly accept whatever path God has in store for you, I guess. And so if that's in the cards, then, for example, I don't desire it, but if God asked me to be a martyr and I was in the situation, I mean, I would accept that as, you know, whatever, his will. I don't know. It seems like if you're desiring martyrdom and you're going out and seeking it, it's almost like the opposite of obedience in the sense that, you know, like...
trying to force God's hand a little bit.
Yeah, it kind of seems like a little bit prideful in terms of, you know, trying to control and direct the situation of like, my path is to be a martyr and so I'm going to go and seek that out as opposed to accepting, you know, like...
So I guess martyrdom really can't be a vocation?
I mean, yeah, I don't know.
My vocation
is martyred.
Yeah. I think about the story of St. Isaac Jogues, one of the North American martyrs who was fingers were cut off, right?
Chewed off, I believe.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay, yeah. His canonical digits,
right,
in particular.
Which is your thumb and forefinger, right. Middle finger.
Oh, okay.
In the olden days, you had to have those three fingers in order to celebrate Mass. And if you didn't have those fingers, you couldn't be a priest.
Right. And so he had to get a special dispensation, but he goes back to France to recover and then chooses to return to continue to preach to the indigenous population.
Knowing he likely
will die. Now, you'd say, well, that seems almost in a sense of desiring death, desiring martyrdom. We don't know for certain, though. What happens if they did convert and they had a change of heart? And maybe some did or the witness did, right? So
yeah.
So you don't know. So he wouldn't have known necessarily, and maybe he had a deep hope that they would convert.
Oh, I think
knowing that the probability was is that they would get killed,
yeah.
Which is what happened.
Yeah, and that was probably the driving force over sort of the danger.
I don't think he
I want to go back so I can die.
I think there's a big difference in sort of those two scenarios.
That's true. I mean, life is a good, and we shouldn't purposely do anything that might endanger that good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's true. It's true. And you look at the lives of the saints and some of them did pray for martyrdom, but I think with the caveat that, you know, it's not something to necessarily pursue, but to allow God to bring it to you if it's his will.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Like if you had to choose like martyrdom today, I mean, I feel like, God, as you think you said, Diane, like God would give you the grace at that moment.
Yeah.
He's not giving us right now.
Right.
Because I worry, like, you know, if a gun is put to my head, would I freak out and deny Jesus just out of fear, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe.
I hope not.
Yeah. But we are humans.
We are human, but I look at the courage of these martyrs and I'm like, where did that come from? It's got to be pure grace.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, we are human, but we have grace.
Yeah.
Which is great.
And so, yeah, it is great. Yeah.
It's great.
You know, martyrdom continues today, too, in many parts of the world. I mean, are you familiar with any martyrs from recently?
There's a whole series in Africa, like Western Africa, right?
Yeah, tell us more.
That's all I know. Well, I know because there's a conflict I think in Western Africa, the Catholic Church is growing very quickly, but also there's like Islam, which is also quite prevalent there as well. And so there's conflict.
This is at least the martyrs. But you don't know any names or any stories.
No, but that's why we have you on the podcast, see.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's still going on in a lot of parts of the world, and it's, you know, we don't hear about it much, sadly, because I think there's a lot, especially in Nigeria in particular, they're having a lot of churches burned down, I know. A lot of attacks on Catholic churches, which is quite a shame.
Well, because it's growing quickly, and it's attracting converts, and people are having big families, and it's a threat to the power structures that are there.
Sure. Yeah, in any place, honestly, where Christianity isn't sort of the dominant religion. I mean, I'm thinking of India, you know, places like that.
Mm.
There's a modern martyrdom, too, that's not necessarily death. I mean, martyrdom, we'll keep that aside, that is specifically dying for one's faith, fine. But there's a little bit of a light martyrdom, we'll call it.
Well, they'll always call it white martyrdom.
White martyrdom, okay.
Yeah, shedding your blood.
Yeah, and so, I mean, in Australia recently, so the Australian government, as far as I know, I'm not like, I'm a little fuzzy on the details, so somebody can fact check me. Go ahead. You don't know my last name. The Australian government has basically mandated that all hospitals have to provide abortion. And the Catholic hospitals said no. And the state said, okay, well, we're going to take you over then. Mm-hmm. You'll be deemed state hospitals. I was like, well, that's a modern martyrdom. You're not able to practice your faith. You're not able to care people in the way that's best.
Yeah.
Or if you think about like cancel culture or anything like that, where if you speak out, for example, if I were to, maybe not right now, my company is a little bit more conservative now, but particularly my last company, if I were to have kind of loudly voiced my opinions on things, my beliefs that are formed by my Catholic faith, I most likely would have been fired immediately.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And in fact, I was just doing some research about 30 seconds ago.
Yes, yes.
The Google. And apparently 52 countries in the world have some sort of restrictions. Maybe it's not shedding blood, but whether it's restrictions on, you know, whether you can worship as Christians, whether you can possess a Bible. I mean, certainly even what you see in China is remarkable, right? The Chinese government has bulldozed churches. They've actually passed a rule that anybody under 18 is not allowed in worship services.
Really?
Yeah, they believe that, something like that.
They have a state-mandated Bible, too, that's been heavily
augmented. Exactly. The Catholic Church is not exactly Catholic. It's, you know,
right,
it's really run by the communists.
Yeah, cynicization, they call it.
Yeah, and they're controlling everything that's said, everything that's read, every you know, piece of art that goes up on someone's wall. You know, even bishops.
So it's no offense to any of you Americans, especially living in a secular culture, which is challenging and difficult. But when I read about that, I'm like, well, our white martyrdom is really nothing compared to the challenges that many of our brothers and sisters throughout the world face. You can still bring a Bible into PwC and not get fired, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So your white martyrdom is like kind of a little small, right? And even
Saudi Arabia is probably one of the most restrictive countries
is
in the
it?
World. It's
is
one it? Of the most, yeah. I think you can bring in a Bible.
Hmm.
But if you give it to anybody, it's an irreversible offense. I'm like I said, I'm a little fuzzy on details, but obviously there's no churches, there's no cap, there's nothing besides like Islam that's allowed to be practiced. It's complete. And if there are underground churches there, and especially in the big American camps of expats and other where other people live too, especially Filipinos, and there is an underground church there. But I mean, like there's priests that will go in and be like plumbers, and it's like, yeah, I'm coming to do some plumbing work on oil rigs, and then they're not
good.
Yeah,
yeah. I think and it's
but they don't go in. They certainly don't go in with their collars.
No, I'm sure not.
Yeah.
I think it's just a beautiful example of sort of the courage and the fortitude that those people have of hopefully that sort of incites us to deeper faith and desire for, you know, for example, the Mass, the Eucharist. I think we take for granted how often, you know, we can receive the Eucharist, right? I mean, it's so readily available here, whereas in China, you know, to your point, Paul, I mean, people are going at 3 o'clock in the morning or whenever they can to these underground sort of things. And there's a lot, I mean, it's not just here. Yeah, you might risk your, what, the way that your reputation, the, you know, sort of the way that other people perceive you, your job, but there's always something, you know, like there's always another job that you can find, things like that.
Yeah, you won't be blacklisted.
Yeah, whereas in China, I mean, it's life or death.
It really is. And so I think the martyrs challenge us to take our faith more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're willing to die for it, there must be something true here. You know? So, but here's the question, though. So, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Silence.
No.
Okay, so it's
man, everything's falling flat.
I'll tell you, you guys don't. I don't know. I need to start recommending books and movies to you. But Silence is fictional. It's not a real movie, but it's about the Portuguese missionaries to Japan in the early late mid 1500s, and the Japanese were not really open to the Western culture, and so it was kind of more of a cultural thing than a religious thing. But they saw Christianity as part of the Western culture, and so they said, "We don't want any Christians in our land." Now, these Portuguese missionaries were working undercover. One of them got arrested and actually went turncoat and gave up his Christianity, apparently, and stepped on a portrait of Christ. That was their test to see if you were willing to do that. And so what happened was these other two missionaries went over to try and see if that's true and to try to bring that apostate priest back. And so they, of course, got captured. And it's really this crisis of conscience with this one particular priest who is suffering immensely, and the Japanese Catholics are suffering. They're suffering crucifixion. They're suffering immense tortures because of this one priest. You know, they're like, just deny, step on this image of Christ, and all these 500 Christians will go free. You know, and so he's torn. He's like, well, in my heart, I believe in Jesus, but maybe Jesus wants me to step on this picture, step on his face, because Christ himself was tortured and tormented, and he comes to the conclusion, sadly, at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, that he does want to step on the face of Christ, and he does. He does do it, and he ends up dying as a Buddhist monk. Yeah, I know, right? It's not really a happy ending.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a question, right? Is it okay when you're in these situations to put on a good face and just keep believing Jesus in your heart? Like, do you really need to step on the face of Christ or to resist stepping on the face of Christ to save your life or to save 500 people's lives? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm just going to throw out a bit of scripture. Matthew chapter 10, verse 33. But whoever denies me before others, I will deny before my heavenly Father.
That makes sense. Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty clear. I think that's pretty crystal clear, at least the way I'm reading it.
Yeah, that is pretty clear. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to be willing to give everything up for Christ.
Hmm.
I mean, at the end of the day, our lives are a gift. We're entrusted with them, right? So we don't actually, like, we're not owners of our life. We're stewards. God has given us this time as a gift. He can take it away at any moment. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I think the whole point of the spiritual life is that we have to sort of understand that and work on giving ourselves away, giving ourselves back to Christ, right? Because he's put us here for distinct reasons. Each of us have our own gifts and graces and all that stuff, but we're not our own. So
yeah.
we can't hold on to the things of this world, including ourselves, like our human existence, because ultimately they're God's. We come from God and we're meant to go back to him.
So, right. And also there's a, maybe a pride there too. And maybe that's why our Lord said that, where it's like, yes, if I step on this, then I can save all of these people.
Mm.
It's like, well, probably not. And if they still practice, they'll probably still
perish. Yeah, and by their suffering, they're sanctifying the world. They're gaining the crown of martyrdom.
Yeah.
Even on behalf of you.
And back to the example of just the inspiration of someone who, you know, I mean, we look at all of these martyrs and I think we're just like, it should fuel us with that desire to grow our charity, right?
Yeah. So would you agree then that we should never make compromises in our faith?
Expound on that.
Well, because I think in everyday life, there's small compromises that we're tempted to make.
Mm-hmm.
Like a perfect example is, you know, let's say you meet someone that's transgender, and you know that she was born a she, and she wants you to call them he, right? Well, by doing so, it's a little betrayal. Right, of what you know to be true, of what you know to be what the Catholic Church teaches. But some might say, well, it's the charitable thing to do. It's the compassionate thing to do, you know, to call them by their new pronoun, by their new name. I mean, what do you hold fast? I mean, because it is a little bit of a betrayal of our Catholic faith to profess something that we know to be not true.
Yeah, I think we have to approach those with prudence, first of all. So in that situation, you would most likely just refer to that person by their name.
But what if their name is, they changed their name to Henry?
Well, I mean, technically, you can legally change your name to anything you want. I mean, it's true. Like, you can change your name. You could change your name. A lot of religious people
they do,
take new names and they legally change their names. So I have less issue with that. But yeah, I mean, there are ways that you can not apostate, to use a very strong term, but by still like affirming a truth that that person's name is their name.
Okay. Right?
So it's nuanced. And then I think you have different, there's different circles of—
How is nuance not compromise?
It's not a compromise.
Okay.
All right. I don't think so. Because if somebody legally changes their name, in my opinion, that is legally their name.
That's fair.
That's the truth. That's like a thing. And
that is true. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So there's that. So I think so again, and I think you have there's different circles too. Like somebody who you're very close with, a family member, you're going to have a much different approach to it than just somebody that you meet on the street that you're never going to see again.
Yeah.
You have a different responsibility to those people.
Sure.
Right. And I think there is a reality there that we have to realize. And so we have to treat, again, using prudence, we have to treat those situations differently.
Yeah. Because, you know, just a lot of the things that the martyrs died for seemed so small to us. You know, it was just bringing one grain of incense to this little statue. Or like in Thomas More's case, right? Just, you can believe all of your Catholic faith, just sign this one small document. Just small, tiny, doesn't mean much, right? He was willing to die for it. Mm. But that small thing, it wasn't like spit on the face of Jesus. No, Henry VIII wasn't asking him to do that. Right, it was upholding the dignity and the indissolubility of marriage and the Pope being the head of the church, which in the grand scheme of things is not the biggest doctrine we have. So I don't know. I feel like, I wonder, it's just such a fine line sometimes between compromising and kind of a compassionate understanding of like the complexity of the situation.
That's nuance, yeah.
That is nuance, yeah.
Nuance influenced by prudence.
Yeah. I guess I would always err. And now, granted, I'm a priest and don't have a family, don't have to worry about, you know, other people other than myself, but I would always err on the side of holding fast to what we believe. But I can understand people perhaps are in different situations where they have various things that they really have to worry about.
Yeah, and I have family members where, you know, they have a daughter who's identifies as transgender or whatever and has taken a new name but not legally, and so her father just refers to as her and as her name and uses her name that he and his ex-wife I guess gave to their daughter and because that's her name.
Yeah.
And but he has a huge responsibility because that's his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's and he has, and there's a truth there that has to be affirmed.
Yeah.
That And he has to make that known to some extent. I wouldn't say it probably wouldn't do any good to be kind of combative with it, but in a way that's the truth, while also communicating the gravity of belief there.
What can you overlook? You know, you have to overlook some things, but not everything.
Right. I mean, you could do your hair however you want. You know,
yeah.
Like fine. Like there's
wear whatever clothes
it's not a compromise, right? That's just the way it is. You know,
yeah.
But certain things like your legal name, the name that you have, the name that as a father, like you may have given your daughter.
Yeah.
And also like the gender, it's like those things are truths that you can affirm in that particular situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think just in general, you know, situations, we can apply this to a whole bunch of different things, but you know, like in terms of communicating to someone who has, I think you have to take into account like sort of where they are, and that's not making an excuse. It's sort of a time and place, right? So hopefully there is a time where you're praying for this person, this intention, whatever. But, you know, a lot of times, for example, if someone's having, you know, fornicating, right? Are you just going to say, well, you shouldn't fornicate? Because they're not going to, if you lay down the law, right, bluntly like that, but they don't understand, they don't have any context, that's not going to, you know, it's just not going to resonate with them.
They're of course not. Yeah.
So there has to be sort of an explanation and yeah.
Well, that's the thing. The martyrs, you know, some of the martyrs, I guess, were martyrs because they stood on soapboxes and preached to the nations. Other martyrs were martyrs because it came to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were just kind of trying to mind their own business and the choice, they were forced with a choice. You know, are you going to go along with the culture or are you going to stand up for what is true,
mm-hmm.
good and beautiful? And that's hard. It's hard. But there's actually a lot of martyrs that haven't actually shed all their blood for Christ. And we say in the church there's this kind of subset of Christian mysticism called victim souls. Have you ever heard of victim souls?
No. What is that?
Really?
I have heard the term, but remind me.
Yeah, so I guess you guys didn't do your research today.
Victims. I always prepare well for these podcasts. I'm sure what are you talking about?
Yeah. Victim souls are people who have chosen, or God has chosen them, really, to suffer immensely, but not die for their faith, but suffer immensely for it. So, for example, a lot of times people with severe illness, some mystics with severe illness are considered victim souls, you know. And it's kind of a beautiful gift that God gives some of his closest friends, is the ability to kind of bear the cross in profound ways. Hmm. In fact, there was one not too long ago. Let's see if I can turn to the Google again and find out. There was one in I think Wisconsin, a man by the name of Francis Hood. You ever heard of this guy?
No.
So Francis, no.
So Francis Hood, I'm sorry, not Wisconsin, New York, maybe? I don't know.
Those are very different states.
Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, there. Maybe I have the name wrong. I'm not sure. He's not coming up here. But I think his name is Francis. And he was a grandfather, totally normal guy, and he had the stigmata. I know, right? Yeah, just this layman, regular, ordinary guy, and he suffered from the stigmata. And that was an incredible gift that God gave him. He had the gift of healing. He had incredible mystical gifts. He would suffer the passion physically, like every week or at least every year, you know, on Good Friday. And who would want that gift, you know? Like the stigmata. I mean, so much pain that comes along with it. But God chose him, and he embraced it. He said, this is my cross that I want to help save souls with.
Yeah, I mean, that's our share in sort of applying the merits, right? Like, that's the role that we play in applying Christ's merits to souls for salvation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I understand his, I mean, I guess God gives everyone different graces, right? So he had the grace to be able to bear that and to desire that. But there's a beauty in sort of, you know, like giving up your life, so to speak, in order to bring others to Christ.
Yeah.
I guess this might be, I don't know if this question makes any sense, but is there a sense that we always get the grace that we need to be saved, but is that the grace, was that suffering essentially the means by which he was going to be saved and turned to salvation?
No, I think God gives victim souls not so much for their own salvation, because they could be saved with a lot less, but to help Christ save others. So I think it's extra grace for them. Okay, I finally found it. His name was Francis Hood.
And where was he from?
He was Houle, H-O-U-L-E. He was from Michigan.
Oh, okay. Which is closer to Wisconsin.
Not New York, closer to Wisconsin, right?
Close. Yeah.
He died in 2009.
Oh, so recent.
Very recent guy. Hmm. Yeah, pretty regular guy. 5 kids, 7 grandkids, and like more than that. You know, he was in the army, worked, and had the stigmata. All right, so
how do you spell it?
His last name, H-O-U-L-E. Irving Francis Houle, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, and that's kind of the cool thing, is that he lived such a humble, unassuming life. Like, we all know about, you know, Padre Pio and his sufferings, but I think there's a lot of victim souls that are specifically hidden victim souls who are willing to offer immense sufferings. Now, I'm not just talking about, like, the ordinary sufferings of, oh, this person's sick, or this, you know, like sufferings that are above and beyond, that are specifically given for the salvation of souls and salvation of others, so that people can live more intimately united with Christ.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, right, that comes from a special grace, but grace does build upon grace. So I think an important thing to remember, too, is that the sanctifying grace that we receive in baptism and that is restored in confession, you know, that actually, it's not stagnant. It grows. It can grow. So our capacity to love grows. And thereby, like, a lot of the saints talk about the different levels of heaven, right? So
yeah,
it's kind of the metaphor of, like, the glass jars, right? You know, you might have 2 different sizes, one really small and another big. And so our capacity to love and to enjoy the beatific vision, I guess, is predicated sort of on that capacity that we build up, which is really a product of sanctifying grace increasing in us through doing good acts. And good acts meaning not good in the sense of what secular society deems good, of, you know, like the object, the intention, the circumstance are sort of all.
Right. All good and all headed towards the salvation of souls.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate goal. And the martyrs lived that out so perfectly. And that's why ultimately, you know, they had the perfect love for Christ, because you can give nothing more than your entire life to him. So last thing before we go is, since probably none of the three of us are going to become martyrs, God willing, you know, hopefully, maybe, I don't know, we'll see. But if not, and we still have this desire to give our entire lives to Christ, how do we do that if we can't shed our blood for him?
Live our vocation well.
Hmm.
Yeah, and continue to work on emptying ourselves so that we can be filled with Christ. We can't be filled with Christ until we're empty of our, you know, our own being. So yeah. That comes through mortification. You know, it comes through thinking of the other for ourselves.
Sure.
All these little things that you do in your everyday life. It means rooting out virtue. Rooting out vice. Forming virtue, right? Because there's sort of those habitual dispositions that we can build ourselves, and there are infused virtues as well, but God doesn't necessarily, I think that we're more sort of open to them once we've built the actual, you know, like the actual virtue.
Yeah, definitely.
Grace built upon grace, you know, like there is, you can increase your sanctifying grace. So it's not a matter of like, what do I need to get bare minimum to get into heaven?
Yeah.
There's always something more that you can do and thereby, you know, become more free and become more fully human and happy.
Yeah. And I think it's not so much the shedding of the blood, but the love with which we do that, that makes the martyr so special. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, that love can be practiced by all who love Christ with their whole heart, soul, mind, and strength.
Right. Charity is the key. It's not sort of the level of the difficulty of the suffering. It's charity that makes it meritorious.
Amen. Absolutely. And so some of the great saints didn't seem to suffer as much, mm-hmm. but they still had charity, and that's what made him a great saint. Mm. Thanks for tuning us in on this episode of Restless. Even though probably we're all not called to be martyrs, we certainly are called to have the martyr's heart of being willing to sacrifice everything for our Lord, whom we love with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. You can find us on Veritas Catholic Network, 1350 AM and 103.9 FM, and wherever you get your podcasts. So tune in next time. God bless.